Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Tinker Talks podcast. I am your host, Mark Hybers, and today we're actually here to talk about Legal Assistance Readiness Week. And I am with the 72nd Air Base Wing staff, Judge Advocate Colonel Janet Eberle. And when I say legal assistance, I don't mean like legal assistance like people that are doing work. We're talking about assistances in helping people. Correct, ma'am?
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Great. Well, thank you very much for joining us this morning. We're here in the courtroom, a very nice courtroom, actually. This is quite the piece on a very rainy day. So we made it over. We didn't float away. But thanks for taking the time
absolutely.
To sit down and join us. I know you've got a real busy schedule and you've got a lot of things to do. So we'll jump right in. If you don't mind, maybe you could just give us a little brief history on who you are, what got you into legal, and what got you to this point in your career.
Absolutely. So I'm Colonel Janet Eberle. I grew up an Air Force brat, so moving all over the country. I went to college in Montana and law school in New Orleans and had never had any intention of joining the military. And then when I got to law school, I started realizing I didn't want a traditional legal career and started looking at some other options and found an internship with the Air Force JAG Corps. And so I spent the summer before my last year of law school at Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana and got to see the whole range of practice that JAGs do. I got to see how much the team was really part of the command team and helping leadership and the commanders on the base. I just really fell in love with the JAG Corps and the mission. And so I joined in 2006 and have been in for now 18 and a half years, worked in justice, overseas, deployed. I've been a staff judge advocate now twice, and nice. Also done a lot in acquisitions law. So it's been a fun ride.
Very cool, and already a full-bird colonel. That's high-speed train.
The tempering of that is that we, I'm what's called a direct appointee, so we get some constructive credit for having gone to law school. So when we come in, so I went through college and law school entirely on my own, and after I took the bar exam and passed that is when I came in. So that takes about 3.5 years to do law school and the bar exam, and so the Air Force gives us constructive credit. So we come in as first lieutenants, and at about the six-month mark, make captain. So as a result, it looks like I've I'm really early to colonel, but I'm just right on time with the JAG Corps. So
perfect. Well, that's cool. That's a nice benefit. Actually.
It is.
That's
it
a
is
very
indeed.
Good benefit. So you go from Montana,
yeah,
to New Orleans.
Yes.
I don't want to get too far off the topic at hand, but how does that happen?
I was in college. I started as a biology. I was the classic biology pre-vet medical-y kind of person who at some point realizes this isn't quite for me and I want to switch. And I switched to history and decided to go to law school. Part of being a well-rounded biology student and trying to stand out, I did Model United Nations and Model Arab League and got really interested in international law. And Tulane had a great international law program with opportunities to study abroad. And so that's why I picked Tulane.
Interesting. Very cool.
Yeah.
All right, so we're here talking about Legal Assistance Readiness Week. So is that new, or what is that week?
Absolutely, so yes, so this is the very first Legal Assistance Readiness Week. We're gonna do this annually. 1 May is Law Day, and traditionally the JAG Corps has across the Air Force done some different events in commemoration of Law Day. A lot of times we'll go and do kind of mock trials of the Three Little Pigs at an elementary school, say, or a middle school, things like that, to kind of raise awareness about the legal profession. But really focusing in SecDef's priorities on making us more lethal, having, kind of focusing in on that readiness. Our 3-star JAG, General Plummer, directed that we do a Legal Assistance Readiness Week as part of the Law Day timeframe. So the 28th of April to the 2nd of May is the first one. We're going to do this annually and really pushing out the message to our clientele of what does it mean to be legally ready, so that we can increase our mission readiness and also expand our services for that week. So for example, this week we've increased the number of legal assistance appointments by 50%. We've increased our hours for walk-in powers of attorney and notaries by 100%. And so we're really trying to target our active duty population to make sure that they are in fact being able to get the services in a timely fashion and early, so that when they do get the short notice deployment tasker, they're not amongst all the other things having to worry about, okay, do I have the powers of attorney necessary for this? Do I have my will set up? Do I have all my documents? Are my things taken care of in that fashion? So that's really what we're trying to focus on, is helping folks understand what it means to be legally ready so that we can be mission ready.
Right. And I would love to be in a classroom to watch you guys do a trial of the three little pigs. Like, that's got to be great.
Yeah, it is. It's really fun. The kids always love it.
That's too cool. And you talk about, so I think most people, when they're thinking of judge advocates, the military legal system, you know, you guys are just doing one thing, like going after doing the trials, the court martials. But I mean, just the things that you talked about, so much goes into what you guys do. Like, it takes a big team, but why is, you have all these things that you do, but why is military justice so critical to the military, to our Air Force?
Absolutely. So military justice is really getting after good order and discipline, mm-hmm. and ensuring that we are both setting the standard and enforcing the standard so that our airmen understand what they're supposed to be doing. If they're getting a little bit off track, we're getting timely corrections in so that we can get them back on track. Because frankly, our airmen are our most valuable resources. We spend so much money mm-hmm. training them, getting them ready and prepared, and it takes a long time to do that as well. So it is far more important for us to be able to have someone who is kind of maybe not meeting the mark, they're starting to have some discipline issues, to get them back on track and rehabilitated than it is for us to be able to push them out. Now, if somebody has committed a significant serious crime, we need to hold them accountable, because that's important. We, you know, making sure folks understand that what the standard is and enforcing that is really important for commanders to be able to have a disciplined force, so that when they go down range, they're not dealing with somebody who is committing crimes against other members in their unit or maybe in the local population. And so being able to enforce that standard and make sure that folks understand what they're supposed to be doing and that they're seeing that there is accountability right. is a critical part of a commander's job to enforce good order and discipline and be able to execute their mission.
Right. And I think what you say makes a lot of sense about readiness in general. Like, we talk about families, having your family life in order. You know, there's a lot of things that go into readiness. It's not just being able to do push-ups and go run a mile and a half or whatever the mileage is, but knowing that you're working with people who are disciplined and you know that you're not going to have to worry about bad things, nefarious things happening to you, like, it's just crucial for readiness at all levels. And I mean, it goes without saying that military people, there's a lot asked of them. You come in real young, you know, it's brand new, mm-hmm. and keeping good order and discipline, like, is just critical for the tougher things that are coming when a commander or when the nation calls on some of the difficult tasks that we do. So very cool. Can you explain to me what happens, like, because the military falls under its own legal system, what happens if one of our airmen gets into trouble off base, like, and then they've got to go through that process too?
Sure, absolutely. So there's federal and state jurisdiction. You'll hear folks talk about double jeopardy sometimes, have heard that concept. Technically, state jurisdiction and federal jurisdiction, we can actually technically both prosecute, but by policy, the Air Force will not prosecute a case if the state is prosecuting. So usually downtown is going to be in some fashion the state. We will actually call and talk to the prosecutors to see, are you planning to take the case? Would you like to give us jurisdiction? Sometimes we have significant interests. Maybe some of the conduct happened on the base, or it involves two airmen, perhaps. Mm-hmm. There may be some nexus where we have a really strong interest in asking for that jurisdiction. And so we'll have a conversation with them about, you know, is it a case that they're willing to give us jurisdiction, in which case the commander has authority and we'll proceed from there under the UCMJ. But if not, if it stays downtown, then there's still administrative action that can happen, and often does. So, for example, a lot of times you'll hear about people getting caught drunk driving downtown. That's probably our most common mm-hmm. Downtown offense. And they'll often receive some sort of administrative action, paperwork, and potentially a demotion action as part of the kind of process to say, hey, that's not within standards, and I'm holding you accountable for the fact that you're doing that. They don't go to a trial with us because they're being prosecuted downtown, but we will follow the case as it's going downtown and advise the commander as it goes. For certain offenses, an airman, if they receive a civilian conviction for some of the offenses, require a commander to then consider them for administrative discharge, which again is an administrative action. It's not a criminal action. And so that often will happen with that. Also, we'll have a lot of times when folks are deployed or they're stationed overseas, they might get in trouble with the local, in some fashion, with the local officials. And that can be a really big issue. It can cause a lot of international scrutiny. I've been in places where we've had protests because of military members committing crimes in the public in Japan. And so under those, we have what's called a status of forces agreement, where we actually have an agreement with the host nation country as to how we're gonna deal with crimes that are committed by military members when they are in the country, who has kind of primary jurisdiction and how we can request jurisdiction. Right. And so a lot of those cases, the host nation country may, you know, kind of want the person to be out of their country, and so they're happy to give us jurisdiction and take that. But I've also had cases where they were unwilling, you know, they wanted to prosecute, they wanted to have their trial, and you don't get all of the constitutional rights. You're subject to the rights that you have in that country. And so depending on where you are, that can be significantly different than the protections you have here in the United States.
Well, I bet it is. And you bring up good points too, like you're talking about host country sensitivities and the different things that you guys need to do. So you go through a standard law school in mm-hmm. 3 years, I think, mm-hmm. for that. How much more learning is there to become a lawyer, I guess lawyer,
yeah,
in the military.
In the military, absolutely.
Yes, what's that like?
So we do, we have an initial training in the Air Force. It's our Judge Advocate Staff Officer course, JSOC, and that is about 9 weeks long, and that when our young lieutenants go to that course, they are learning the all the different aspects of military law. So we're looking at all of our civil law aspects, looking into ops law, doing a very significant block on military justice, and learning the kind of rules of court and all of that. A lot of the rules of evidence are modeled after the federal rules of evidence. Mm-hmm. So there's some things that they will have already learned in law school, and we're just kind of honing their skills and getting them better for that. But we do that, and then we also have continuing legal education. So we consistently throughout our career will go back for courses where they're focused on different aspects of our job. We do training in-house. We'll bring in folks to train. We leverage our reservists a lot for that. So right now I've got a reserve officer with us for a 2-week annual tour, and she is a federal defense attorney and has practiced. She's worked at the commissions and done a lot of litigation, and so she's working with the team this week on some of their litigation skills. So we leverage training like crazy throughout our time in, mm-hmm. so that we can actually hone our craft. And then there's also opportunities to go get your Master's of Law degree, which I actually did. It's usually kind of senior captain, early major is when we'll go do that. So about 7-8 years into our career. But we have a competitive selection process to go, and you will go and get a kind of advanced, it's a 1-year Master's of Law degree in a different distinct practice area. So we have criminal justice, military justice, folks doing masters in that. I did one in government acquisition and fiscal law. We also do labor law, environmental law, and there's quite a bit in national security law and space law. Right. So kind of some neat opportunities to go and do advanced education.
Yours can't be the most exciting in the world.
I like to say that acquisitions is absolutely the most interesting thing in the world. We are, when you look at the Air Force mission, and the Secretary of the Air Force is charged with presenting, organizing, training, and equipping to present ready forces to our combatant commanders. Mm-hmm. You cannot do that without acquisitions. Right. There is not anybody who goes and does the cool operation law deployment, mm-hmm. they are working in and having to learn fiscal law and acquisitions, because the first thing that's going to happen is the commander is going to come in and be like, hey, I've got, Polish forces that we're wanting to do training with, but they don't have the right equipment. How do I get them the equipment? How do we make sure that we're doing this appropriately? And that all requires generally some knowledge of fiscal law and being able to get your commander to yes on that. There's lots of lots of contracts that go into moving us around, getting us the equipment we need, getting us the weapon systems that we need to be able to go out and fight the fight. So I personally think acquisition law is pretty cool, and we can deep dive into that. But it's definitely it's near and dear to my heart.
It's not the one that's highlighted most on the TV shows.
Yes, though, that's absolutely. For sure. It doesn't make for good television. That's for sure.
So you get a Juris Doctorate. Yes. Same as any other mm-hmm. attorney in the world, and then you can specialize in the military with the master's degree. So how different is military justice system to a civilian justice system? Is it real different, or are they very similar?
There are some similarities. Obviously, we still have, we all have the Constitution as our base that does dictate a lot of what we do in terms of, we have constitutional rights about searches and seizures, and you can't be put in jail without having a hearing. And so a lot of those different parts and pieces are similar. There's some really unique, I think personally awesome things about the UCMJ and the military justice system that the civilian system doesn't have. So for example, on the civilian system, you have a right to an attorney, and one is provided for you if you can't afford it.
Right.
In the military, if you are accused of a crime, we provide you an attorney. We don't care what your finances are. We are going to provide you an attorney. And not only are we going to provide you an attorney, we're probably going to provide you more than one attorney. Our significant cases that go to trial will have two or three defense counsel here. I've had in my courtroom, incredible litigators, defending their folks against my first assignment captains and one senior trial counsel. So we really stack the deck on the side of the defense counsel and pushing our best and brightest over there. And on the civilian side, it's kind of whoever they can get into public defender, which they're great. They do a great job, and they're really passionate about it. But we actually push people to go into the defense community because they have great litigation skills, and we want our airmen to have the best that they can. The other really cool factoid about the UCMJ is that Article 31 rights, which is anybody in the military suspects you of a crime, mm-hmm. If they want to ask you a question that's going to incriminate you, they have to read you your Article 31 rights, mm-hmm. Which is very similar to the Miranda rights. It's you've got the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. But those existed well before Miranda rights.
Really?
And they're also more expansive. So the Supreme Court actually, in Arizona v. Miranda, discussed the military system and how we had Article 31 rights to be able to kind of showcase that this was something that wouldn't hamper police ability to go out and investigate, which was that was one of the big claims and pushing against having to read rights. And so they modeled the Miranda rights after the Article 31 rights. And so those existed awesome. Before, and they're also more expansive. So downtown, if you're suspected of a crime, until they're doing what's called a custodial hearing or a custodial interview, which means you're being arrested, you can't leave. You know, if you can get up and leave, they don't have to read you your rights. And so it's, you see it all the time in the TV shows. They don't read them their rights until they're arresting them at the end. It's probably not completely accurate, but you are much more likely to have a lot of conversations with a police officer without being read your rights downtown versus for us to be able to use anything against you, we've generally got to read you your Article 31 rights. And so the protections that you have as a military member under our criminal justice system are much more expansive than they are in the civilian world.
That's awesome. And just for anybody that's listening and watching, that doesn't mean that it's easier.
Yeah.
Like the standards in the military is still very high, just
right.
Because you have a lot of afforded protections, and that just definitely does not mean that it's going to be much easier.
Absolutely.
And so with all that, what is a commander's role? Like, what's our wing commander's role in the military justice world?
Sure, absolutely. So so our wing commander, as the installation commander, she is a special court-martial convening authority, which means she can actually send a criminal trial to a court, to a mm-hmm. special court-martial. It does have limitations on how much jail time somebody can receive at it, and they can't have anything worse than a bad conduct discharge at that trial. But she has a really critical role in the good order and discipline process for the Air Force and here at Team Tinker in terms of being able to have that. She's also for the most part, she ends up being our discharge authority. So most of our discharge cases. She is the one who will decide whether or not to discharge an airman and whether or not they should get, what the service characterization is as they're heading out under an involuntary separation. And she, of course, oversees my office. And so, you know, we report to her on all the criminal matters that are going on the installation at any given time. But overall, commanders generally have that critical role of being the one who is supposed to be maintaining good order and discipline. And so that can be through, you know, court martial actions. Those are kind of our big cases. That's takes a lot of time to get to. That's not that volume wise the largest thing that we do. There is a lot of UCMJ action under Article 15, which is sort of like a paper case. Mm-hmm. A commander will serve a member, say, this is what I think you did wrong. Here's the evidence against you. Come back to me. You have 3 duty days. Here's your area defense counsel. Here's an appointment for you. Come back to me with your response, and then I will consider your response and decide, you know, whether or not you've committed the crime and how to punish you. It's not, it doesn't result in any sort of federal conviction, but it does allow a commander to take a stripe, take some forfeitures, impose restrictions on them, give them extra duties, maybe to have to work a little bit longer if maybe, you know, we'll use that sometimes if somebody's not showing up to work or being kind of delinquent on, like, not following their technical orders, things like that. Right. But ultimately, it gives a commander a lot of options to be able to rehabilitate that airman back to being in standards. And so that's it. But the commander's the huge critical role in all of that. The UCMJ gives them a lot of authorities in terms of being able to authorize searches over what they have under their control. So for the Airbase Wing Commander, she controls the installation, so she can actually order a search anywhere on the installation. A squadron commander, a group commander, could maybe order a search of an office space something going on in their actual area of domain. And it also gets into when we get into commander-directed investigations, and they have inherent authority to investigate. And so we'll see a lot of informal inquiries by commanders where they're like, I've got something going on. It's not something that rises to a security forces or an OSI investigation, but I need somebody to go take some statements and figure out what's happening and what good order and discipline issues I'm having in my unit.
Right. So it's kind of mind-blowing, really, because you think about, like, Colonel Rosetta, our boss, and we both work directly in mm-hmm. the wing staff agency, like, how much she already has on her plate daily to run a base like Tinker as the installation commander and then running the wing. But then you throw all this stuff on top too. And I'm guessing from the sounds of it, she's kind of like a judge in some cases, like you're presenting things to her and then she has the, like, a basic, here's several different things, options that you could choose to take action. Is that accurate?
That's probably fair. I would say, depending on what it is, right? It's the on the administrative side, there's a lot of, you know, choices that she has and authority mm-hmm. that she has to that the, you know, the Secretary of the Air Force through regulation has delegated down. Mm-hmm. So like on the discharge side, that's an area. On the court side, for her, she's somebody who is the decider to say, okay, this should go to a court case, or this should go to the next step. I think this should go in front of a judge, and this should go in front of a panel of members to decide whether somebody is guilty or not guilty, that this is a crime that warrants going to a court martial. We have had in the last year and a half kind of the stand-up of the Office of Special Trial Counsel, and that has mm-hmm. impacted commanders' authorities. So there is a list of about 20 UCMJ articles that fall under the Office of Special Trial Counsel. So they actually have the jurisdiction over the investigations and what to do with the case. To start, they do get input from the commanders, and so for every single one of those, the majority of our cases that fall under their jurisdiction are in the sexual assault realm. Mm-hmm. But we will get input from Colonel Rosetta and the squadron commander and group, you know, the different commanders in the chain to see what they think should be done, and then it goes up to the Office of Special Trial Counsel, and the attorneys there will actually analyze the case, look at the evidence, decide, do we have enough to go to court? Sometimes it's, we have enough to go to court, but this isn't the level of a crime that should go to a court and should have a federal conviction. Sometimes it's, we'd love to go to court, but we don't have participation from a victim whose testimony we would need to be able to put it on. Mm-hmm. And so they will make a decision to either prefer charges or defer it back to the command to take action, you know, to take whatever appropriate action, which can potentially be no action depending on what we have. So so that has kind of adjusted a little bit some of the authorities that commanders have. But that was something that was has been talked about for a long time, and Congress decided that we should go that route of having attorneys decide on these really big criminal cases.
Well, what an incredibly unique role that is.
Yeah.
And probably a lot of weight. You know, the commander's already got a lot on their plate to deal with.
Absolutely.
Is that one of the decisions you think that Congress decided to move some of that off the plate, maybe?
So I think some of it was, we've gone through, kind of a lot of scrutiny on how we, particularly on the sexual assault cases, how we prosecute them, what we offer. There's been a lot of changes over the years. Just in my career, when I was interning, we had started the SAPR program started the summer that I interned, and we had, restricted reporting was a brand new thing, and making that available to victims to be able to get help without having to immediately be interviewed and go through the investigation and all of the parts and pieces that go along with that and the stressors of that. And maybe eventually they're going to get to a point where they're ready, but maybe not. And that's right. And either one is okay. That was brand new. And then over the years, we've gotten better and more adept at how do we help our victims? How do we make the system fair? We've added Victims Council. So the Air Force was the first one to stand up. What was the Special Victims Council program is now the Victims Council program, where some of our victims are actually eligible to have an attorney to represent them, and they will represent them for example in motions hearings and some of the different portions of the trial. They actually get to come in and argue, right. and advise a victim. And so there's been some movement along the way, and because there's been scrutiny on how we have handled them, how victims have felt represented, and Congress's interest and scrutiny into that process. And so kind of over the course of time, there was a lot of looking at, on the civilian side, there's no commander involved, right? It's just right. The prosecutor. The prosecutor decides whether or not to take a case to court. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you, downtown, they prosecute far less than what we do in terms of, you know, cases. They're kind of if I don't have the smoking gun, it's not necessarily going to go to trial.
Right.
And so so there was an interest of from Congress to kind of take it out of the hands of the commanders. I think some may have thought that that commanders were maybe too close to the accused. Mm-hmm. Some may have thought they were too close to the victim. Right, wrong, or indifferent, I think, you know, Congress has given us direction, and we're executing to that, where we've got our where they have taken specific crimes and put them in the hands of our JAGs, who belong to the Office of Special Trial Counsel, which is actually a direct report to the Secretary of the Air Force. So they're a completely separate chain, right, from the rest of the JAG Corps while they're in it. So it's been a lot of movement on that, but overall, I think the intent was kind of this: let's have neutral and detached people and look a little bit more like the civilian system.
Right, not a bad idea. So how different is a court-martial proceeding from, say, a trial downtown?
Absolutely. So it's different in that, so downtown, right, you're going to have a huge jury of your 12 of your, quote, peers. Mm-hmm. They may or may not look anything like you or be anything like you. Here in our system, we have what are called standing panels. So we'll have a group of 100 officers and enlisted members who've been nominated by their commander based on their age, experience, background, judicial temperament, to actually sit and hear cases. And then those are selected by the convening authority to be on the panel. And then when we actually get to court, you can be tried by a military judge alone, mm-hmm. or you can have a panel of members. And so you'll have, for a general court-martial, there's 8 members. And they do not necessarily have to come to a unanimous decision, which is a little different than downtown. So there's some differences in that regard, but I would also say we're a bit more rigorous in getting to a panel with our folks. I think downtown you often see much more commonly cases will plead out, whereas we litigate a lot of our cases.
Right.
And so that's a big difference that you'll see here as well.
Also part of the holding the standards, very mm-hmm. different level. And downtown, I know lots of prosecutors and defense attorneys, they run in the same circles. They are, you know, quote unquote friends, or at least acquaintances in some shape, form, or fashion. But different from the military, where you may have prosecutors and defense attorneys that, I mean, they're training together, they're doing their readiness together, they're doing their PT together, they may, I guess, deploy together, but is that unique, and is it a challenge for them to have to serve like the serve that you serve for, to defend the Constitution, but also when it comes to, like, you know, a prosecutor and a defense attorney having to represent and do their job? Is that challenging?
So I think we put a really big focus in the JAG Corps, and I would say within the legal profession generally, on our ethical standards and our professional conduct standards. So mm-hmm. we have annually, we actually review all of our ethics standards, we have professional conduct standards, we have trial standards, that speak to how we interact with opposing counsel and making sure that we are, you know, cordial, that we're being appropriate, and all of that. And I think that really creates an environment that folks understand they're doing their job the same way we're doing our job. Right. And so, but the other piece of it is we're very specific to make sure that the lines of authority and who you're working for are separated. So the Area Defense Council here does not report to me. Okay. They are assigned to an O6 up in DC. Mm-hmm. They have their own chain of command. They very much will leverage that chain of command. If they're having, you know, if they feel like they're having issues with my office, I may mm-hmm. get I'll usually get a courtesy call from them saying, "Hey, ma'am, there's this issue. Want to bring to your attention." The same way I would if I was having an issue with another organization on the installation. But they also, you know, their leadership is not afraid to pick up the phone and say, "Hey, we've got a problem and need to bring this to your attention," or "We need to advocate, our folks need help with space on the installation," or something like that. One of the big things we did here was working to get the 6G Wi-Fi rolled out in Building 1 so that our ADC and Victims Council offices had the ability to have, when they had visiting counsel come in, that those folks had access to internet to be able to better represent their clients. And so we take that very seriously, and we also make sure that we keep things separated appropriately. And so there is some amount of, you know, you can't be friends with everybody mm-hmm. That comes with this job, but I think overall there's an understanding that that we expect we expect all of our folks to zealously advocate for their clients to the best of their ability, mm-hmm. And that in doing that we're all professional and it's you know, we're cordial to each other because that's, you know, that's part of just being human. Right. But overall, we understand that they've got a mission and they understand that we do as well. So
right. Awesome. And I think it goes without saying, you know, the opinion may be that the lawyers and all that, you're the bad guys and, you know, you're the gotcha people. But I mean, truly, with everything that you guys do and what you bring to the fight as far as the ability to maintain standards, and, you know, you guys are just doing, you're just doing what you're supposed to do to make sure that we're all marching to the same standard and ethical. I mean, obviously people mess up. Like, you're not here to just beat them down to death when that happens, but you're not the bad people.
Absolutely. Well, and I would say, like, a lot of our mission, you know, people associate us because of TV shows and movies right. with this courtroom, right? Mm-hmm. And what we do here. But if you look at my team of, I've got 36 professionals who work for me, only 6 or 7 of them are in the military justice realm. I've got a whole team of attorneys that are advising on acquisitions and working with the complex and our programs offices that are here in AFSC, working, you know, getting after really big issues with how do we, you know, the commercial reengineering program for the B-52 and getting our B-2s and B-1s and doing sustainment on all the engines on all these things. So there's a huge mission going on there. I've got 7 labor attorneys who are who help keep us in line as we are, you know, getting allegations in EEOC or MSPB. If folks are saying, "Hey, there's been an unfair labor practice against me," or working with grievances with the union and kind of working through that process and helping support the 19,000 civilian employees that work here on the installation and making sure we're doing that right. I've got an environmental law team that is working on helping us get after all of our compliance requirements that we're doing, to make sure, right? Like, we're making sure we're doing all those things right, working on land acquisitions, working, you know, on the peaking plant to be able to get after for energy resiliency. So that's a whole separate mission that has nothing to do with the criminal law.
Right.
And my civil law team, which is they have they're my catch-all. So they're doing anything that requires a legal review that doesn't fall into acquisitions or labor or environmental. Or military justice ends up with them. So they get all the questions about, you know, hey, this regulation says this, what does this mean right now while we're doing all the executive orders and being able to implement and figuring out, okay, how does the executive order interface with the regulations we currently have and the guidance that we're getting and the laws that we have in place that Congress and the president have enacted, and working through all of that. And so there's a huge amount. And then finally, our legal assistance mission is a huge part of our of what we do every day in terms of helping our, you know, airmen, their families, reservists who are getting ready to deploy, and our retirees who need to be able to, you know, who are having issues in the family law world. They want a will, they want a power of attorney. So there's a huge amount of work that we do. And really, I would argue, most of what we're doing is problem solving.
Right.
My team's there to help the, you know, commanders and our customers figure out, okay, we've got a problem, we need to solve it. How do we do that, you know, within legal bounds? Where are the areas we can take risk? What is the risk we're taking? Is that reasonable? Mm-hmm. So that we can help the decision authorities kind of figure out what they need to do.
And I'm glad we bring that up, because that was kind of like the meat and potatoes of, you know, you guys are so much more than just the courtroom, although the courtroom's nice and, you know, it's a good backdrop for a setting like this. But and our offices overlap a lot,
yeah.
Like public affairs and the legal, you know, I send a lot of legal reviews up, and a lot of people don't know, like, everything we do outside the fence that's got military or civilians involved, especially the commander. You know, we mm-hmm. work directly for the commander. If there's a $27 lunch, you know, he's just like, hey, you know, we're not going to put our boss at risk because we didn't have a legal review on this. So, you know, hats off to you guys. 36 people sounds like a lot, but on a mega base like this, I'm sure it's, you guys are probably pushed fairly thin on staffing resources.
We love the mission, and it's a great group of people. So it's I always say I'm the luckiest staff judge advocate in the Air Force getting to lead here at Tinker.
I love that. And with that, I think we'll wrap up there, ma'am.
Absolutely.
I know I've been hearing this thunder going for quite a while, so it's not, it doesn't have anything to do with legal and the thunder and the lightning. It's just coincidence. But thank you so much for taking time out
Absolutely.
Of your day to come join us. And with that, we will wrap up another episode of the Tinker Talks podcast. Again, I'm your host, Mark Hybers. Please don't forget to join us on the socials. That's Facebook and Instagram at Team Tinker. And then on X, that is at @team_Tinker. So until next time, thanks for joining us, and you guys stay safe out there.